Welcome to Mormon Happy Hour. My name is Colleen Dietz. Join me and my guests each week for an entertaining recap of the hottest topics in Mormonism. We keep tabs on social media and headline news so you don't have to. Don't miss our live pro tips as you adjust to your new and exciting post-Mormon life. Mormon Happy Hour is here to bring you the irreverent side of Mormonism, wherever you may be. Welcome to episode 79. I don't want to give too much of a recap because I do that in the panel. I want you to know that this is a well-rounded discussion where we try to be trauma-informed in our discussion and evaluation of all of the characters in this current controversy. And please, if you are not currently aware, check the show notes and maybe follow a few links, watch a few videos if you want, or you can just listen to us digest the information that has already been presented elsewhere. And if you want early release to panels such as this and the full video, check out Patreon. This was available almost a day early on Patreon. So it's a lot easier and faster for me to get stuff up on Patreon. Plus, I like to reward those who financially support Mormon Happy Hour because that's the only way that we can continue to do this. So anyway, thank you for those of you on Patreon. If you're not, check it out. You can get early release and so much more bonus material. Anyway, please enjoy, and I would love to hear your feedback and if this discussion changed your mind at all. And hey, you know, if you disagree, tell us why. All right, please enjoy, buckle up, and get a drink. Also, stick around for part two. This was just far too long for one episode. So 79 will be part one and 80 will be part two. See you in the next one. Welcome to Mormon Happy Hour. I am joined today by three of my most favorite people that I could gather for this discussion. This just felt right. So I wanted to go down the line and we'll introduce from maybe the most known to our new joinee. So welcome to Bryce Blankenagle. You all know Bryce Blankenagle from Naked Mormonism. Would you like to say hi, Bryce?
Hi. Thank you for including me as listed in the chats when you're putting this together as your token penis. I'm glad to fill that role. Thank you.
I did say that.
But no, to be fair, like you and I have been discussing this whole subject since this all broke a year ago. You and I have been hot on this, like in public fora, together in closed chats. Like this is something that you and I have been following very closely for a long time, and I appreciate you inviting me on to talk about this. There's kind of a lot to unpack.
There is. And thank you for the expertise that you bring when it comes to like tying it back into church. You have great insight into turning it back into the LDS church, which I appreciate. Like
that's why we're all here.
The other penises that are in charge, what are they called?
The penis hood.
The penis hood, pretty much. All right. And then Leslie Butterfield, thank you so much for joining again. Do you want to say hi too?
Hello. Yes, I'm here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, Leslie, you have some, I think because of the nature of this discussion, we're going to drop some credentials. Okay. Just that's how it's going to be. So Leslie, can you share with us kind of some specialized training that you have?
So I am a registered nurse with 10 years of experience. I work in the field of community health and mental illness and trauma-informed care. So I have trainings in all of those areas, and I have functioned as a victim advocate and many, many other things that sort of inform my views that I'll be sharing here today.
And last but not least, my good friend Janelle. This is just the weirdest full circle relationship in the world. So Janelle and I met in our young teens at an EFY, which is especially for youth, which is the Mormon Youth Camp in the summer. That's where we met. And then we both did our undergrad in psychology at BYU. So we had some classes in common. We know we did. And then we reconnected in like 2016 on Facebook. And I'm like, you look really familiar. And then I was going through pictures and I'm like, I have a picture of you. So lo and behold, this is Janelle. And she has continued her education in the field of psychology and mental health and social work. So welcome, Janelle. Thank you so much for joining us in the panel. And do you want to kind of cred drop for us?
Absolutely. So yeah, no, I'm thrilled to be here. I'm so excited to talk about this. So I am a social worker and a trauma fellow. My background is working with people with personality disorders, also a lot of background in crisis intervention. So with that perspective in mind, I've been thinking a lot about that as this whole situation has come down. I hope to kind of share from that perspective. And last but not least, also a very dedicated cat lover. So if you see me screwing and messing around off screen, it is her fault. So you see me like,
nice.
Perfect. Thank you for having me.
And yes, absolutely. Thank you for being willing to come on. And I also have I do have a bachelor's in psychology. I have worked in the field of mental health and I do have professional experience with the clinical treatment of borderline or personality disorders and other mental health issues and crisis and whatnot. So I have some experience. And the other thing that I think is relevant to this conversation is I'm also a rape/sexual assault survivor. And I feel like that's very relevant right here in this discussion to just put that out there, that that's also a perspective that I'm coming from in addressing these issues. Let's just go ahead and get to the issue at hand. We will introduce it. We're going to be addressing a video that was released on the YouTube channel New Name Noah by Mike Norton, where he describes in a 45-minute video much of the past of McKenna Denson, who is the woman who has accused her missionary training center president back in, what was the year? Does anybody know the year off the top of their head?
I think it was 82, 83.
Yep. Okay. So that was the time frame that she was at the missionary training center, and she has accused the president, whose name is Joseph Bishop, of sexually assaulting, raping her in the basement of the missionary training center. And then subsequently, through much of her life in efforts to report the abuse, she was basically shuttled around and not given any justice from the LDS Church, from officials that she spoke to of the LDS Church. That particular, she then confronted Joseph Bishop in a recorded audio that was released exactly a year ago, right around. It was March of 2018, I want to say, when it was released. And that's on MormonLeaks.io. It's still on their newsroom link. And so that's kind of the relevance of McKenna Denson. Then she obviously has been a very prominent member of our community fighting for a Mormon Me Too movement. She has made quite a identity for herself doing that. So then this video is kind of it brings up a lot of things from her past and some current things that have kind of given us all pause, and we've had to kind of reevaluate how we see McKenna and how there's lots of complex issues. So if you haven't watched, if you haven't listened to the recording originally a year ago, that's a good place to start. If you haven't watched the video from New Name Noah, that's probably another place where you're going to want to catch up on, or maybe not a lot of these things will make sense. But that's the framework, the foundation that we're going to be working from. And before we get started, I do have a bit of a disclaimer. To be honest, we're all a little apprehensive about having this conversation because this topic is so radioactive. So here's this is from our legal counsel, disclaimer. We're going to do our best at presenting the facts available in an objective but evaluative manner, given the fact that information, analysis, and reactions are still pouring in, and we will undoubtedly make mistakes here today. We also claim the privilege of changing our opinions that we may present here, given more information or time to reflect on things. So that's just to let you know that we're definitely going to fuck up, and we're definitely going to change our minds and our feelings. And I've tried my best to compile a panel of people that actually have differing opinions. So you're going to hear some that are mad at some things, and other people are going to push back, and we all have different opinions. So hopefully you find someone here that you agree with at least a little bit, or, you know, you can just hear a bunch of different opinions and perspectives.
And then send all of your hate mail to Mormon Happy Hour on Twitter.
Pretty much. Twitter, that's way too public. Tell them to send it to mormonhappyhour@gmail.com, please.
Okay, that one.
Okay.
Radioactive is a great way to describe this. Like, everybody who touches this issue is getting burned, if they weren't already mm-hmm. burned before, just by the existence of all of these allegations. So, I know that I've told you, Colleen, that I'm very apprehensive about this, and we have all shared that on our private chat prior, you know, putting this panel together, just because mm-hmm. no matter what you say, you're going to create an enemy for yourself in the community, because this is just such a he said, she said, and such a combative and divisive issue that reveals mm-hmm. some deep and dark undercurrents that are going on inside the community that really need to be discussed.
Absolutely. And I like what you said about how we're changing our opinions, and we're going to continue to change our opinions. I kind of want to bring up, I listened to Mike's call with McKenna in preparation for this panel. I had not listened to it prior than that. Before listening to the call, I was a little bit more, to simplify drastically, Team Mike. I thought I knew what I was going to present, and I thought that a lot of it was somewhat justifying of him, or at least sympathetic to him. And that shifted when I listened to the call. So that's just an example that I hope that I can continue to be open to ways that my opinion can shift, at least, because it already has.
Oh, that was another thing that I didn't mention, is that in addition to the 45-minute video of his, basically a dossier prepared against McKenna, he then also released about 14-minute phone call that he had with McKenna discussing the items. And basically, we'll talk about it later. I think Bryce has some choice words prepared for that we'll probably close on. I don't know, or take an intermission while he rants and raves. That's, you know, whatever, wherever the mood takes us. Okay, so let's get into this so it doesn't take all night. God, where would we like to start?
Should we just start with Mike and the video and the things that he presented in the video? And
like the specifics?
We can present the specifics if we want, but yeah, the whole situation. Does anyone want to give a rundown of the video? So he did this video, it's like 45 minutes. In it, he basically covers the things that were in the dossier that the church compiled. Is mm-hmm. that right, to everyone's understanding?
And also more information too, more updated information. It's expanded from the original dossier that many of us have already read when it was initially compiled in April of 2018, I believe.
Right.
So it was just an expanded version of that original dossier.
Go ahead, Leslie. Did you want to run it down? I mean, I don't even. Yeah.
I don't know if I have any interest in running it down. Like, so for me, just from my perspective, there were about four people last April, it was about April, May, who decided to start Mormon Me Too as a Facebook group and just kind of nurture the movement if we could in any way. And that's not to say that anyone had any sort of claim over it. But there were decisions made to, you know, to do that. And it has been a bumpy road, because we were up against a lot of difficulty in the community. Just the fact that there were people that were starting a Mormon Me Too Facebook group was traumatizing to survivors in itself. And it is, you know, a group just to share. McKenna was very much a part of it, and she has been fluid, I would say, in her involvement in the group. So sometimes she's actively posting, and sometimes she's not in the group at all. And you know, that's, I think one thing that, anyone knows who have, who has worked with McKenna or had any conversation with her at all, knows that McKenna is going to do what McKenna wants to do. And, it's really up to the individuals who, you know, are working with her, who are friendly with her, to decide how they want to take things and decide, you know, what boundaries they would like to set in whatever, you know, kind of issues they may start to see or whatever. So, and I can get into a little more of that later, but anyway, Mike, presented this dossier. I feel like I already knew most of what was in it. There's some specifics that I would say I didn't know exactly. And I've since, after seeing Mike, I've since gotten more information from the, I don't know what to call it, from the other side, from people who are close to McKenna. You know, so I've tried to vet some of these things a little bit more and increase my understanding, because I do feel like Mike presented a lot of what he presented with his own bias, and he presented it as fact. And I feel like that is an important thing to acknowledge, because it's being taken as fact. And I'm just personally wondering, you know, if anyone else has vetted those things, like anyone else on this call, have you vetted those stories? Have you gotten the backstory? Have you gotten any other alternative explanation than what Mike has told us? Anybody?
No. And I'd be willing to bet that almost every single other person in the community who is sounding off about this are in the same boat as everybody else on the call, that no, we're just taking it at face value, which is, it's a failing on everybody's part.
Yeah. And that is, that's exactly the point that I would make, Bryce.
My only thought is that yes, that is absolutely a failing. I recognize that, but maybe this is an assumption that other people have too, but a majority are police reports that she filed herself. And so I just trusted that because she was filing the police report herself, then they were accurate as according to her, if that makes any sense. I trusted that much.
Right. But so what was shown from the police report? So the police don't believe her? We know the police, rape survivors don't file a police report because the police don't believe them. I mean, that's not news. Exactly. Like,
well, and that's kind of one of the big issues underlying all of McKenna's entire history, is that there haven't really been any solid convictions of any of the rape allegations that she has made against anybody. Mm-hmm. But my understanding is that like only 5 out of every 100 accusations or police reports that are filed concerning sexual assault or rape actually result in convictions and prosecutions, regardless of whether or not there's truth to them. So that's not a very good litmus test for whether or not she has been, you know, the victim of rape or sexual assault in the past, whether or not there was a conviction on them. It just shows that there's a major lacking in the ability of the legal system to prosecute and fact find on issues like this. And like police reports find that somebody with 3 gunshot wounds to the chest was a suicide, right? Like, we can't trust police reports as base ground level fact.
Right.
That's already really problematic.
One thought is, or a phrase that comes to mind is a preponderance of the evidence. So I think it's an individual choice for people who are viewing this, who are consuming this information, who are watching Mike Norton's video, who are part of the community, to look at what's presented and to basically make that decision for themselves. What standard of evidence do we feel personally good about as far as where we stand and how we're interpreting what's happening? I do think it's an excellent point that this is from the perspective of Mike's bias. I don't think anybody here would deny he's got a whole lot of that. One thing I at least appreciated is that he did cite his sources. And I think that in doing so, he at least created some opportunity for the viewer to come to their own conclusion. Do they feel that, that standard has been met, at least as far as where they personally are comfortable comfortable at coming to a conclusion. And I see that as a really important function that this panel can serve, in that we can highlight where that bias might be, and we can point out where the case may not be as watertight as maybe as he presented it to a less questioning viewer. I also do think it's important to draw attention to the fact that when there is a very clear pattern that's been established of behavior, it becomes a bit implausible to suggest that certain things are a coincidence or just happenstance that it keeps happening like that. So I will say that I probably share some of the bias, in that it does seem to me that that whether or not every single case is watertight, that there's a clear pattern of criminal behavior and being a scam artist in her past. That I personally was satisfied to that degree.
Janelle, something I want you to talk about is something that we kind of talked off the air, is the, I'm going to forget the term that you used.
Negative attributional bias. My new favorite Thank phrase you. That I love to teach people.
Yeah, can you please talk about that? Because I think that's really relevant.
Absolutely. And it's an interesting lens to use to view both sides of this. And I think that's what I found most interesting, is that I'm seeing it on both sides. So a negative attributional bias would be where you are predisposed to view anything that comes from a certain source in a certain way, because it is, you're predisposed to see things negatively. Now, there's actually an overall negative attributional bias, which would be a person who just interprets everything in a negative way, but I'm not referring to that. I'm referring to a specific negative attributional bias towards sources who we have already predetermined to be to be untrustworthy, because there's such a thing as a positive attributional bias too. But what I wanted to highlight was the negative one. So, and we're seeing it on both sides. So on our side. On the ex-Mormon communities, I believe it seems to be an apparent negative attributional bias that Mike Norton was not the person to discover McKenna's past. He's just the messenger that we were able to hear it from. Because the truth is, mm-hmm. that information had been, maybe not every bit of it, maybe not in the exact same order or the exact same quantities, but this information had been compiled by the Mormon Church as it was facing the allegations that McKenna was presenting. And we wrote it off really quickly because it was coming from the Mormon Church. The other thing is it aligns so closely with an explanation that was so familiar to us. We are so sadly familiar with the way that rape victims are smeared, where the defense goes the ugly path and tries to dig for dirt in the history of any woman that tries to come forward with her rape and press charges in an attempt to smear her credibility so that she won't be believed and she won't be listened to. It's a very ugly thing. It's a very real problem. And the Mormon Church seemed to just be following that pattern to a T, and so we dismissed it. We just said, oh, look, there that same thing's happening again. How awful of them. And we didn't look into it. We didn't look past our own bias to say, well, what are they saying? What information have they found on her? We had a negative attributional bias towards information that came from the Mormon Church on this case. And I think that's something we as a community do need to reckon with, because it turns out we had bias and we couldn't hear it until it came from one of our own. On the other mm-hmm. side, and this has been just fascinating for me to watch. I can report on at least one Mormon forum, because I have participated, and I can't reflect on all of them, but the one that I am in, just watching them reckon with this news as it broke, because this group, Mike Norton is the devil incarnate. they really, really, really don't like this guy. They hold strong resentment because he's committed the ultimate in what, in the LDS perspective, on blasphemy. He's filmed their sacred temples and put it online. That's unforgivable in their view, and they have very strong feeling for him because of that. And yet, on the other hand, they're delighted that McKenna has been taken down, because they're happy that she is no longer pressing the charges that she has been pressing, at least to my understanding, or at least that she's not credible in the way that she was before. So it's watching them reckon with, they see it as a good thing that that this information is now out and is now being shared and is now being listened to. They see it as a good thing that it's affected her support. But they're reckoning with the source. Can they acknowledge who the messenger was? And it seems that what I was seeing is people either couldn't admit that Mike had done something helpful, or they were looking for negative or hostile or sinister or corrupt interpretations for why he broke the news and why he did it in the way that he did. So it's an inability to see anything good coming from Mike Norton due to a negative attribution bias that they hold towards Mike Norton. So I think that's just interesting and worth noting, because we are talking about bias here tonight, which we all have, very much including myself. And I think that it's not a question of whether or not we have bias, because that's part of the human condition and experience. I think it's a question of, are we able to recognize our own bias, and are we able to reckon with that? So I think that's an interesting perspective to look at this.
Yeah, and I would like to sort of address that point too. I feel like there is a lot of that going on, and I definitely can see anyone on any side has that tendency to, you know, partake in their negative attributional bias in any situation. In this situation, I'm also seeing our patriarchal conditioning taking over. Like, to me, someone who has worked very, very hard to unpack patriarchy in my own life and to call it out when I see it and to push back on it in any situation, no matter if it is an ex-Mormon who's on my side, you know, against the harms that the church is creating, or if it's the church itself. Like, you know, to me, when I see something like that, misogyny, patriarchy being reinforced and patterned, even in the ex-Mormon community, I will speak back against that in the way that I feel is appropriate. But in this situation, and kind of with my kind of situation from the beginning, I have the utmost compassion in my heart space for how her story has been co-opted and treated and used by many men in our ex-Mormon and progressive Mormon space. Even in the beginning, her recording was published without her consent or knowledge by men that I personally, you know, would say I have a friendship with and I have a respect, but I cannot agree with that decision that they made. I feel like that was very harmful, you know, and that conversation kind of came and went. And whether or not I, you know, McKenna even really pushed back on that. I mean, she said that it was fine that her recording was out there and it didn't do her any harm and it was actually good. You know, she might say something different now, because of what has happened now, because all of a sudden an ex-Mormon man gets on Facebook and we're all waiting so anxiously for his, you know, groundbreaking, completely sensationalized in a very disturbing manner, might I add, video, an expose, as he called it. And we are so quick to believe him, to not question him, and to crucify and destroy someone simply because a man tells us that we should do that. And he demonstrates it for us on a phone call that, might I add, was very verbally abusive and not okay in any situation. And so on Facebook, you know, people are posting McKenna's picture with the word liar stamped across her face. They're harassing her. This is bullying. This is cyberbullying. And it like, you're destroying a person's life. Okay. And it's just not okay. It's not okay. And for us not to recognize those patterns, that we are reinforcing them. We are reinforcing them over and over and over and over again. Like, I don't know what else to do. It's black and white. It's white and black. And to me, it's not that issue. It's a both and issue. It's, yes, McKenna has had some issues, but this was not okay. This is not okay.
I mean, I'll say I personally don't feel that we're being told to do that just because a man said so. I'll kind of go back to Mike did cite his sources. We've talked about his bias, but he did cite his sources. So I think that he pointed to his sources and said, this is why, and did create space for us to come to our own interpretation and conclusion. It seems to me people have overwhelmingly come to the conclusion that She is a scam artist. She is a criminal. She does have this very troubled path of using it, past of using and abusing people, because there is, in fact, the corroborating evidence to back that up. He went over it exhaustively in his videos. He has all the various documentation. She herself admitted to most of it. But I think this would be a good time to pivot to the community's response, because I think that's really the significance of what we want to be reflecting on, is what's coming out of this? How are people reckoning with this? How are people discussing it, and what meaning is being created out of it? And I'm not sure if I want to take the lead on that. Does anybody have anything to say along those lines?
Sure. I have a couple bulleted points, just what the impact that I think that this all has, like, on the community, and some issues that I've been wrestling with on, well, you know, how far does this go? I feel like personally, I've devoted a lot of time to supporting her cause through Mormon Happy Hour and other various things, because she is also a survivor of sexual assault. That's not debatable. That's a fact. Whether it was Joseph Bishop or countless other people in her past, I believe her. And so, you know, I have supported her in that way. And this has had an impact on me, because, you know, I have to question now her motives because of the information that's been shared. And so I feel like I've been complicit in her scam to some degree, when that scam is applied to the ex-Mormon community. I'm upset with the impacts that this entire bombshell, this nuclear thing right here that we're discussing, which is the, as Leslie very aptly pointed out, it's very, what's the word you used?
Radioactive? No.
No, Leslie.
I mean, it's co-opted patriarchal narcissism is what this is. Like, to me,
but it's very inflammatory, right?
Right.
And so that's the way he's presenting it. And so basically, the effect that this is going to have, from what I see as a survivor myself, is that it's going to set back to such an incredible degree the tendency for people to believe survivors when they come forward. Because, like, here she is, this prominent figure that has now been publicly smeared as being a liar and a scam artist. And so it has such a negative effect. And I don't know right now where to put that blame. And I don't know if it's appropriate to put it anywhere other than the community who is interpreting the information. And so, like, I don't know that it's Mike's fault. I don't know that it's McKenna's fault. It's how we are all as a community interpreting the information. And I see it as a huge step backwards for the community. And I don't know how to turn that around or to fight against that step backwards. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Do you guys have any thoughts on that?
I do blame McKenna. I'm not saying I only blame McKenna, but I think it's clear that she did not act in good faith. I think it's clear that she has major integrity issues, to say the least. I think it's clear that she has a pattern of using people for her own gain, for her own selfish interests. I think she has a clear pattern of playing victim, of justifying herself, and of wriggling out of responsibility in ways that are not ethical, in avoiding crimes that harm people. And just the way you said, I think that the big picture on this is the way it impacts survivors of rape who are going to come forward in the future and who are going to find it that much more difficult to believed, because she is such an ever-present reality in people's minds of someone who could not be believed. Now, with that said, though, because I do blame her, but I think that there's another individual who's extremely strong in this case who we're also talking about, which is Mike Norton. Obviously, he's also very much been front and center for how this narrative has played out, and there's a lot to blame for him, too, because in a lot of ways, he really did not handle this well. And I feel like there's things I want to say about this, which we almost can't say because we haven't touched the topic yet, which is his phone call to her. So maybe, and tell me if you guys agree, maybe we could pivot to talking about that phone call that he recorded and put out, because I think that it's going to come up in everything else that we have to say. Who wants to introduce that?
Well, I just like I to push back on something that you said real quick. So you proceeded to just say, you know, that McKenna has a pattern of these things and that she's destructive and caused damage. But then I did ask you where your sources were, and you declined to tell me that. So
no,
again, I'm just asking.
No. Mike Norton's video, he exhaustively cited his sources, and I'm referring back to them.
And which were what? Police reports? What?
I haven't compiled exhaustive notes on exactly what he covered in his video. I think any one of us could review the video and decide for ourselves whether or not we consider his sources to be accurate.
Right, but if you hold that strong of an opinion, I mean, you should be able to aptly cite your sources where they came from, rather than just
they came from my friend's video, and I reviewed them, and you reviewed them, and we've all reviewed them. They're there. Go watch the video.
Right. I've watched the video, and I've also spoken and tried to vet as many of these things as I can personally with people who personally know McKenna, who knows these situations, and you know, I've reached a different conclusion.
And
do you want to share with us your conclusions, Lily?
Right. Well, my conclusion really is that, and besides all of the minutiae, like I said, I knew most of these things. There might be a few other details, you know, that have come forward, but I've known a lot of these things, and I can tell you that piece by piece, if you go through and ask what happened, and you search for a backstory, or you ask for an explanation, that to me, I'm satisfied with some of those things, with the backstory, with the explanation, with whoever is running a smear campaign against McKenna. For me personally, I'm close enough to the situation and I know enough about it that I can say I can make that informed decision to have the opinion I have. So I'm very uncomfortable, you know, sitting here as a professional and judging as a victim advocate and judging somebody for allegations in their past. Like that makes me very uncomfortable. And as me as a rape survivor, I mean, I can tell you, I was raped by two men in one night. Okay. And that is not the only time that I was sexually assaulted or raped in my life. So if I would have filed reports on every single one of those situations, and if a dossier has been, you know, was compiled against me, and it was presented like it was against McKenna, like I wouldn't come out like an angel either. And I don't think, to your point, Colleen, I don't think that I don't think it helps sexual assault victims. I don't think it helps rape victims to have a pattern that of men, you know, presenting these things and instructing everyone else what to think about them. I don't think it helps to have a pattern of men sitting on this information, like John DeLynn and Sam Young and Mike Norton and Ethan Kroc and whoever else, Bill Reel, sitting on this information and just waiting for Mike to sensationalize it. That is horrible. Horrible. As a victim advocate, I am outraged that that is the case here. Instead of presenting it responsibly, instead of, you know, maybe asking her what happened or maybe saying, you know what, there's some deeper issues that we need to look at together as a community. You know, maybe using principles of trauma-informed care. And I mean, I don't even have words to describe how horrible it is. And equally horrible is the response of everybody, again, to just, let's judge this issue black and white. McKenna is the scam artist. And, you know, let's all set up our camps in that corner. I mean, it's not black or white to me, you know, and maybe I've functioned in this space for long enough to know that people are just not black or white. They're not all good. I respect Mike. I call him a friend too, you know, but that doesn't mean that I give him a pass for some of his behaviors. And McKenna too, by the way. You know, I've had concerns about McKenna's behaviors, and whether that's, you know, me setting private boundaries and thinking how I want to think and interacting how I feel I need to with McKenna, that's what I do, you know, but I wouldn't publicly, you know, victim shame somebody because I found out things that I didn't know before.
So I will say that I feel that it's disingenuous to characterize the exhaustive evidence that Mike presented as nothing but a smear campaign. He did cite his sources.
But I didn't characterize it as that.
You called it a smear campaign. You did call it a smear campaign. Pulling back to the bigger picture, though, because there's obviously some very strong opinions and strong feelings on this matter, not just between the four of us, but in the community in general. So I kind of want to discuss what I've observed in the community overall, because just kind of pulling back to see what the patterns are overall, what I'm seeing is Very few people have found McKenna to be innocent. The consensus does seem to be consolidating that she has lost credibility, that she is guilty of fraud, that she's guilty of scamming people, and that we as a community cannot continue to support her in the way that we have before because she is so problematic. So I think that maybe what we can do moving forward in this panel is kind of discuss the trends and what the significance of these conversations are and what that means for the community as a whole as we watch the community pull back away from her, because that is what's happening right now.
I would say that's not what's happening. I'm seeing really, really hopeful, good responses from responsible people who I respect so much. I have seen that in several groups, Facebook groups. And yeah, it's not the Facebook groups that, you know, might be active Mormons. It's not the Facebook groups that might be run by the ex-Mormon patriarchy. But I am seeing that responsible, in my opinion, responsible and less black and white response to this issue in a lot of groups, a lot of different groups. Colleen, you're in some of the groups with me, and have you seen that?
Those are not the things that are popping up in my newsfeed, probably because those aren't the most explosive and popular opinions. But would you be willing to share, I guess, some of the perspectives that you're seeing that are more healthy?
Yeah, I mean, healthy in my opinion, I guess, as, you know, coming from the background and experience that I have. Many people say that you know, these things in her past indicate that there has been a level of trauma, that she has experienced a level of trauma, whether that's for us to judge or not, you know, and use to formulate our opinion. I mean, we can leave it that there, but I was surprised to see that. And I was surprised for a lot of people to recognize that the skepticism, I guess, and I know Bryce can speak to more of that later, but the skepticism of starting to question, I mean, just as they were questioning McKenna's stories, like, and I think that's where some of this started, you know, is questioning some new things that have come forward. But I also see that people are questioning how this was done. I see that people are operating with love, compassion, care, kindness, and that's refreshing. To me, that's refreshing. You know, as a community, I feel that we have a responsibility to not re-injure the injured and to not re-traumatize the traumatized and to try to guide ourselves with some sort of moral responsibility and compassion. And I have been happy to at least see some of that, you know, here. So that's kind of, I don't know, the rundown. I'm not going to mention specific groups or anything because that's private, but yeah, I have seen that. And I'll tell you, it is a lot of female led groups and people who have been victimized and victims. So it's coming from that perspective. It's coming from the perspective of people who recognize the patriarchy within our ex-Mormon community and, you know, push against that. You know, and so I want to acknowledge that. I want to acknowledge that there are compassionate responses, and, you know, I hope I can add my voice to be a compassionate one in this issue.
So what I was prepared to talk about, and I am a little surprised by the direction this discussion is going, because what I was prepared to talk about is, given her extensive criminal history and given her demonstrated lack of trustworthiness, what would be a compassionate way to reckon that against the trauma that she's experienced? What seems to be emerging is a deep skepticism that she's guilty. And I'm kind of reformulating really quickly to try to think about how to respond to that, because that that surprises me, because I have it's not only not my perception, but I haven't seen that perception yet, and I have been all over this. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could speak to that.
Seen it either.
Yeah, I mean, like, has she been convicted of any of this?
So there's a very big difference between a legal conviction and whether or not a person is actually innocent.
Right, which Mike aptly made that point on his phone call to McKenna. You know, he said, because, you know, thank heaven the David guy who was who McKenna had accused of rape was not convicted. And somehow that professes, you know, that McKenna made this whole thing up. And I mean, so I would apply that same thing. Has McKenna been, you know, if we're going to apply my reason and logic here, you know, that seems to be so unsurpassed that everybody is going to take our cues from him. Let's apply that here. You know, let's apply, has McKenna been convicted of any of this?
So everything I had prepared to speak to was to speak to what do we as a group and as a community do once we find somebody who has committed the crimes and committed the offenses that she has committed in our midst, especially given her mental health conditions and the trauma she's experienced. So given what you're saying now, I am at a loss for how to respond to that, because it didn't occur to me that somebody would look at the collection of evidence that is here and would come to the conclusion that she is innocent. That's very surprising to me.
I didn't say she was innocent. I said, I think that it is responsible and prudent of us to not assume she's guilty. That's what I said. And part of, you know, just podcasting is rolling with the punches and just, you know, having a conversation. So I'm sorry if it's not in the outline, but, you know, that's kind of where the conversation went. So we can get back on track if that would, you know, make you feel more comfortable, but you know,
I'm just reflecting on where I'm coming from. I'm more or less narrating the thoughts as they go through my head and as I reflect mm-hmm. on this. I guess rolling with the punches, as you say, this is one thought that does occur to me, and it is that our movement, our call to stop protecting sexual predators in the LDS Church has been all about asking and requesting the LDS Church that when they find a predator in their midst, they should not cover up, they should not make excuses, they need to evict that person from their midst, they need to call it out. So I think it's very important to not have a double standard. And when we find a predator in our own midst, we need to hold ourselves to the same standard. We need to call it out. We need to name it as it is. We need to not be making excuses. From that perspective, I think it's very important that we reckon with what we've learned about McKenna and that we do not justify her or cover her up just because she's one of us.
Janelle, I'm totally comfortable with you going ahead with what you've prepared, because I think a lot of people in the community do share that opinion. I'm more on that side than, I mean, I'm really wrestling with how I feel about it all as well, but I personally feel like the police reports have demonstrated a pattern of behavior, and I feel like it goes both ways. We can't just say that she hasn't been convicted, so she's innocent. Well, neither has Joseph Bishop or my rapist or, you know, countless other criminals that I know are guilty. They haven't been convicted either. It goes both ways. So if we're going to, I feel like I would like to hear, Janelle, your perspective, especially in your field of expertise when it comes to mental illness and kind of the other topics that are being discussed in regards to McKenna. So would you like to address kind of the things that you have prepared?
Yeah. Yes, and thank you. I saw Bryce raise his hand, and I feel like he's the one we haven't heard from for a long time. Can I pivot to him first, and then maybe I could share those things?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry, I missed it.
Yeah. So I think this will help play into the point that you're going to be making after I speak here. So this ought to be perfect, but I'll just share my own experiences with McKenna, because when this all blew up in March 20th, 21st of 2018, and the whole ex-Mormon and Mormon sphere on the internet caught fire with all of these allegations and the tape that was aired without McKenna's permission. And like a lot of people immediately are up in arms that this guy, Joseph Bishop, you know, he was president of the MTC. He's been in leadership positions his whole life in the church, and he clearly has a problem with sexual abuse. That's very problematic. And it's an issue that many of us have known about, that the church covers up sex abuse, that they pay out billions in settlements for sex abuse. And those are just the settlements that have been made public. The settlements that we don't know about are probably many billions more beyond that. So it's very troubling. And it's also troubling to know that tithing money is going to that. That's money people are paying out of the goodness of their hearts for belief in the church, that they're giving 10% of their income in order to cover up the sex abuse. So one reason why we all rallied behind McKenna so quickly was because her story and the tape that she collected with Joseph Bishop reveal so many troubling aspects within the church that we all know have been a problem, but it detailed exactly how it happens and why it's a problem, right? So she got Joseph Bishop to admit on tape, not to raping her, but to sexual misconduct and very likely assault of at least two other women who were in the MTC at the time. And he also spoke to him, he called himself the Harvey Weinstein of the church, and he spoke to his addiction, whatever that was, whether that's sexual assault, whether that's just, you know, whatever that might be, it could be any number of things, but we know from the other people, not McKenna, who have made statements public, that Joseph Bishop is a sexual predator, and his predation was covered up by the church. We can rally behind McKenna Denson for her work in getting that information out there unequivocally on tape that he confessed to these things. And what that did was reveal the larger trend of the way that the church deals with these issues. On a personal level, about a week after the story went and after, no, so it was, you know, 2 weeks after the story went up, a week after the Protect LDS Children March in Salt Lake City, I was able to get on a phone call with McKenna, and I had to verify that it was McKenna because I didn't, you know, I wasn't sure if it was her or not. And it was great. So like we spoke for, I would say probably an hour and a half just about her story, about the church, about her time in the church, about her time in the MTC, the way that she went about getting the audio recording. And it was a very interesting conversation. And she said at one point in the conversation, something that I cannot remember, but that caused me to have a small red flag pop up. And it was something that I didn't care to pay much mind to, but it was a little bug, you know, it was a little pee under a mattress that I couldn't quite get away from. And then as the year progressed into late 2018 and now into early and mid 2019, more and more things have come up with many of us in the community who have been close to McKenna and who have been close to the Mormon Me Too movement, or, you know, like, you know, Leslie and Colleen, and it sounds like you, Janelle, have been working in the movement. Hearing things about McKenna that have caused us to question our convictions and our understandings of McKenna and try and view her with a bit more nuance and a bit more understanding of where she's coming from, where her mentality currently is, and how those early assaults in her life likely influenced the way that she views the world now, which is obviously something that we all need to deal with. But all of that I want to come back to is the central focus, and I'm going to reiterate this in the conclusion of this podcast, is the main reason that we are all rallying behind McKenna Denson and Mike Norton before this whole public spat came out and this self-destructive eating of our own heroes started. We all rallied behind them because the church protects sexual predators. We never need to lose sight of that, okay? All of us need to come away from this podcast, regardless of this bullshit idea of Team Mike or Team McKenna. That's stupid. That we don't need to put ourselves into camps like this. We don't need to have heroes. We need to come away with the understanding that the church still conducts itself in ways that are problematic and should be illegal. And that is where we need to continue to move forward towards. If this is a divisive issue, sure, it can fracture the community for a minute, but at the end of the day, we're still pissed off at the church because it covers up sexual assault within its ranks. Mm-hmm. We need to come back to that. We all need to understand that is the focus of what we're talking about. This little spat, this is going to go away in a couple weeks. We're not going to care about this in a little while. The church is still going to be covering up for sexual predators at a systematic level for years and decades until more activism happens and they are forced to change. And McKenna Denson, wherever your opinion is of her, she started conversations that needed to happen that moved the ball forward on those changes happening. So for that alone, you know, we can weigh out the balance of her trustworthiness and the effects of her, you know, of her betraying the community. I don't know if you want to call that. I put that in scare quotes for a reason, but we need to weigh that in the balance of what she has done to push the church forward on policy reformation, and the fact that her allegations against Joseph Bishop, they still stand, right? She was still at the MTC when that happened. She described the rape room in detail, and there's corroborating witness that the rape room looked like she described it from other people who were taken down into that room and assaulted and had their blouses ripped off by Joseph Bishop, right? So we need to understand that there are fundamental factual artifacts within her claims against Joseph Bishop that stand the test of time. And Joseph Bishop is still guilty by his own admission of being a sexual predator. And that had she not come forward with that, the tape, all of this, it would not be as open to everybody's perspective as it is now. So I think at the end of the day, if McKenna makes us mad, if McKenna betrayed us, if we're angry at McKenna, she still did a hell of a lot of good in this community to move the conversation forward. And I think we should thank her for that.
So, Bryce, I really appreciate you bringing it back to that focus, because I think that is the bigger picture right there, is how does that affect the movement? And absolutely, this isn't about McKenna. It's not about Mike Norton. It's about what do we do to protect victims of sexual assault within the church? How do we push the church to stop protecting sexual predators? So spot on that one. I'm thinking about because you said, you're right, all of this is about issues that need to be front and center focus. And so the question becomes, how did she affect the way that that's front and center focus? Certainly she brought attention to it. And what is that attention and how has it played out in the narrative? So I don't know, but I can say that I have already seen some people arguing that that our movement has been disproven, that this proves that there is not a problem of sex. This is false, but I've just saying that I've seen this false argument made, that somehow this proves that our cause was unjust, and the fact that one element of it turned out to be scamming us means that the entire premise falls apart, or the entire cause falls apart. Abjectly false. There are thousands upon thousands of victims who we know about, who have come forward, who we support and we promote with our activism. The only thing that was special about, well, I can't say the only thing, that's too broad, but what made McKenna unique and what put her front and center in our movement was her unique willingness to be so public about it, her unique willingness to push back in the face of the kind of pushback that sexual abuse survivors receive when they dare to speak out against a powerful entity. She was fearless in the face of that, and she was relentless in the face of that, and she pushed it and pushed it and pushed it. And it was wonderful to see, because we would never fault a survivor of sexual abuse for wanting to mitigate their own damage and maybe retreat and return to their loved ones and living their lives, because who wants to be re-traumatized in the wake of that kind of thing? And yet being an advocate in that way really is so damaging to a person, and she was willing to take it on. That's why she was so central. She was not so central because she's the only victim we could find. So that's a key misunderstanding. The problem is it is a misunderstanding. And the problem is that a lot of people think that with her fall from grace, the entire movement falls from grace. So my fear, my concern, and my tentative hypothesis is that she has undone all the good that she has done, because I think that it's being taken in the popular eye. Again, we're talking about the popular eye, not we're talking about people's general broad perceptions. I think that people now interpret the entire movement from the lens that it is all about false allegations, because she is now at least perceived as having made a false allegation. Now, I'm with you. People who scam, people who lie, people who do the things that she has done can be raped. Are raped. In fact, one could even argue that they're more vulnerable to rape, because one could argue that predators will target people who are vulnerable because they're less likely to be believed. So there's actually a strong argument to be made that not only does her problematic history not mean she's immune to being raped, but it could actually make her more vulnerable to being raped. So I am fully with you that this in no means justifies Joseph Bishop. The concern is how this affects the movement overall, because the concern is how it affects women in the future coming forward with their allegations of rape. If this makes it so that they are less likely to be believed, then that is devastating.
I can agree with that, but I also disagree to a certain extent, because one bad actor within the community doesn't destroy the community. The community will grow, the community will adapt, it will evolve, it will overcome, and it will get past any perceived transgressions of McKenna Denson and Mike Norton.
I agree with that too.
The thing is like this may be a McKenna Denson was a two steps forward for the community. Right now, what we may be witnessing could be a one or two or maybe even a three steps back. And that is troubling. But what I also think could be a positive result of this, and it's a whole mixed bag. There's many results of what has happened and what is currently transpiring right in front of us. But another positive result, a positive way to interpret this, is it may create a little bit more robustness in the movement, in that people are willing to see that if somebody comes in under false pretenses for any matter, or if they are a bad actor in any respect, then they will be found out, they will be discovered, and they will be punished in the court of public opinion, whether for right or wrong. Now, why I introduce that is because there was a bad actor within the community of Mormon historians in the 1980s. This guy was forging documents and selling them for a shitload of money to the church and to other private collectors. Eventually, he was found out. And then in order to cover up his crimes, he tried to blow up. Well, he blew up and killed two people and nearly blew himself up. And then he was convicted, and now he's currently still in jail for it. But the Mormon historian community was burned for a long time. And as a result, 35, 40 years later, is interestingly much more careful about vetting sources. Now, that may not be as effective in the short term, but in the long term, it makes the entire community of Mormon history more robust and more accepted in the field of academia, because they had this reconciling event, this huge event that everybody had to step back and say, oh, what the fuck are we doing here? We need to think about these things a little more critically. I feel like this is one of those reconciling events where the people who, if there are bad actors in the community who may be working under false pretenses for their own self-aggrandizement, I'm not saying that's what McKenna did. I'm just saying that her actions could be perceived that way. If there are other actors within the community who are doing that, this may scare them off from doing that. At the same time, it's likely going to scare off genuine people who are now more afraid to come forward because they've seen the results of what happens. That's a very legitimate concern, and that could be the three or four steps backwards from the two steps that she helped to bring the community forward. That's troubling. There's no way to look at this entire issue and say it's all good, all bad. There's just a huge mixed bag of results coming out of this, and we just need to take it all in totality.
I think it's kind of ironic that you bring up bad actors who are perceived as, self-aggrandizing and in it for personal gain and notoriety. And I think it's funny because Mike Norton falls under that category for many, many people. That accusation is thrown around all the time. And so I think it's kind of ironic that now both of these figures are being accused of that. And I like how you brought up that, maybe we can grow and become a better community as a result of this experience. I really hope that's the direction that we take, because, it is a scary thing to kind of live through as a victim myself, and to kind of, wait out how the community is going to, react to victims. How are we doing?
We have some trailing topics that we didn't quite round back to. One of them is the incredibly problematic phone calls that Mike Norton had conducted with McKenna. I'm kind of inclined to start there. You also invited me on my soapbox, but maybe we can get to that in a little bit. Do you want to start with the phone call?
I did not listen to the phone call. I don't know if I'm going to, but you guys can take over. I can weigh in on what I know about it, but I did not listen, so I'll turn it over to someone else.
So I listened to it specifically in preparation for this panel. I was dreading listening to it because everything I'd heard suggested that it was very ugly, and I don't really enjoy wallowing in that. It's why I had avoided it. It was really ugly. It was pretty bad. So just kind of a brief recap. So Mike gets McKenna on the phone and kind of blindsides her. No, he does blindside her. It's apparent that they have been talking about what Mike Norton has been finding out about her, and that this is a follow-up call to that. It appears that the most recent thing that she's responding to is her scam of cancer victims, where she was posing as if she had cancer in an attempt to receive donations that were intended for cancer victims. And she was calling back to try to explain herself. And her explanation put mental illness front and center. She stated that she has a diagnosis of BPD, borderline personality disorder. She also stated that she has a diagnosis of DID, dissociative identity disorder. She states that she does not recall the scam that she has put forward. She says, if I did it, then I need to own that, which I found to be a very interesting statement, because she's not owning it. She's saying, if I did it. But that's how the call begins. He then begins to call her out. She says, well, you don't have to be my friend. He says, oh, it is way beyond that. And then at that point, he lets loose on her, both barrels blazing. And he rips her up one side and down the other. And I was disheartened is an understatement. I was discouraged to hear how he spoke to her. There was some, I want to highlight what I see as the most problematic parts of how he spoke to her. He stated to her that if she was present there before him, because this was a phone call, but that if she was present in person, that he would punch her between the eyes. He suggested that suicide would be a positive outcome for her. And he just repeatedly used really ugly, abusive language. I'm not going to repeat it. That he used some really ugly language to call her all sorts of names. She doesn't really respond. She basically listens. Eventually he slows down and says, do you have anything to say? And she says, nope, I'm good. This happens repeatedly. And she just consistently says, nope, I'm good. So it kind of ends at that point where he's gone all guns blazing at her and she's kind of just held back. And he lets her know at the beginning of the call that he is recording the call and that he will be posting it for all the thousands of people. So I have many reflections on this. I think that we all are probably going to get pretty aligned on this one, because you can't justify this call. It was ugly. One of my major reflections on this call is just that, not just that he mishandled it, but that in his mishandling, he distorted the overall focus from where it needs to be. Because what he could have done is stayed cool and calm and collected and confronted her with the facts without going all guns blazing. And then he could have allowed all of us to hear how she reckons with that. Instead, he becomes center focus of what goes down, where it's all about just how ugly he's being and how whatever emotional satisfaction he's getting from laying into her that viciously. And she looks great with her calm composure compared to him. And that, and I feel like I've really seen that shift the narrative in the communities as they've moved forward, because everybody is really thinking hard about how he mishandled this. And, you know, the way that Mike Norton mishandled this is not the important thing. I view that overall as a distraction, because, and this is going to pivot back to the point that Bryce made, what's important is not McKenna's specific situation or her as an individual. What's important is, are we making ourselves better prepared or less prepared to protect, to protect those who have been raped and to help them to be believed and supported moving forward? That's what we need to be focusing on. But instead, it turned the entire discussion into being all about whether or not Mike Norton is justified in letting loose with all his rage. And that's just not the point.
Yeah, I can speak to that a little bit. Like, so Mike Norton's first video, I watched that. Okay. I wasn't any outraged, obviously, whatever. Then I listened to the phone call. And as a survivor of abuse, and I don't think that anybody who has experienced horrific verbal abuse like that would deny that that is verbal abuse. It's verbal abuse. Verbal abuse. And, you know, the National Center for Domestic Violence, they have a power and control wheel. I'm just going to read a few of those things. Using coercion and threats, Using intimidation, using emotional abuse, minimizing, denying, blaming, using male privilege, and verbal abuse. And I think he did a lot of those on that 14-minute phone call. If you can, you know, believe, and I know that Bryce will get to a little bit more of that, but if you can believe that he fit that all in a 14-minute phone call, he did. And what was sort of surprising to me was the people who were not correctly labeling that as verbally abusive. And the people who said, well, he was angry. You know, he let her into his home. And like, I will always, coming from a background that I'm coming from, and that's informing my bias, and I'm very, you know, amenable to admitting that, there is nothing that anyone does that deserves abuse, period. Anger does not excuse abuse. Abuse does not deserve abuse. Betrayal does not deserve abuse. You know, any of these scamming someone does not deserve abuse. And the fact that we are even having a conversation to not have a conversation or to somehow, you know, focus on McKenna and not focus on this huge thing that Mike showed us, this is verbal abuse, and we're having a really hard time recognizing that as a community. And that concerns me greatly, because many of us left the church or have stepped away from the church because of abusive issues, you know? And so to me, that makes me feel very unsafe. It makes me feel like I'm in an unhealthy community. You know, it makes me scared for victims, to be honest, you know, and whether some of that might be my own trauma being triggered, but that was not okay. And I will never say that anyone deserved that. And I will call that what it was. Bryce, go ahead. I'm sure you have something to say after that.
I have kind of a lot to say, and it's going to take a while. I think Colleen has something to interject here.
I'll just be quick. I just wanted to admit my own thoughts that as I was thinking them, especially in relation to this panel, I'm like, oh God, I'm going to sound like I'm, you know, like a Mike Norton apologist, and I'm not. But the thoughts that went, again, I didn't listen to the call myself. I only know what was in the call from a written text, which is, I understand, very different than listening to the verbal abuse. But in hearing what was contained in the call, my thoughts were, well, he's reacting out of a place of fear, where he feels like he has been betrayed. He feels like he's been exploited by an individual who has, through the research that he did, convinced him that she is reckless in throwing out accusations to ruin people. And so I'm like, well, maybe he reacted the way he did because he felt like he had to go on the offense to protect himself. Doesn't justify what he did, but I was just trying to think of why he would react in such a way. And I saw a lot of like speculation, like, oh, well, they must have had an affair. It seems so personal to him. We're just going to find out about the affair later. And I don't think that's true at all. I think just based on what he has, the assumptions that he has made, the conclusions that he has come to, that was just something that I thought was like, oh, well, he felt like he had to go to those lengths. Not saying he did, but that's a thought that I had.
Yeah. So can we like even think about applying that same logic to McKenna's past?
What do you mean?
Can any of us think about applying that same logic? Maybe she felt like she had to go to some of these lengths that she went to. I mean, is that even a thought for any of us to do that here? I mean, yeah, I mean, I don't, and that's the thing is, like, I don't have any interest in presenting this as a black and white issue or a false dichotomy or holding up someone, you know, as this hero, like Bryce said, you know, but it's kind of like, why is it like that? Like, in our community, why are we seeing these responses that are, okay, let's excuse the verbal abuse, but let's not give McKenna any sort of excuse at all. You know, in fact, let's crucify her online, you know, to the point that it could be damaging to her physically. Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's do that. I mean, it is insane. It's so irresponsible and not okay. You know, I work as a triage nurse in some of my spare time. And I can tell you that, and I've worked this job for many, many years. I can tell you that the rates in mental health and mental illness calls that I get have skyrocketed over the, over, you know, my course of employment there. And I think a lot of it is because it's so easy. It's so easy in this day and age to online bully. It's so easy to, you know, take something that a picture or a snapshot or, you know, a 45 minute video that someone puts out there for whatever motives they put out there and literally destroy someone's life. You know, and I will not participate in that. I just won't.
So I appreciate you're speaking to context, that we have to look at the broader picture of a person's behavior in terms of the context. I appreciate that because you're raising a valid point. And I want to reflect on also on what Colleen said about wondering where he's coming from and imagining a place of fear. And I want to pivot to kind of a broader perspective on abuse. And I think we all here on this panel are in consensus that he was behaving abusively on that call. I think that's pretty clear. Abuse needs to be interpreted in the context of the relationship. So this goes to what I was saying about how my opinion did shift when I watched the call, because what I thought I was going to think moved in a direction after I saw it. I was inclined to interpret his actions a little bit more generously before I listened to it. And once I listened to it, I realized that they're really that generous interpretation really didn't hold. It really was inexcusable. So I think I still want to make my point, just because these themes are coming up in the broader community. It doesn't apply as much to Mike as I had hoped it would. And the point being, that it's difficult from the outside to view one interaction and to interpret who is the victim and who is the perpetrator, because the same because abuse is about control. It's about controlling the victim, and it is about the power balance. And it's less that than the details of an interaction. Now, again, I say that from the perspective that was verbal abuse that we saw on that call. So again, this is more of a broader point than specific to this case, but it is a theme that I've seen over time, that it can be very, very, very difficult to interpret. Is what we're seeing abuse, or is what we're seeing justified anger as a person in a healthy way reclaims their power in standing up to their abuser? Is what we're seeing somebody finally speaking up about the harm that they have suffered, or is what we're talking about somebody who is seeking reinforcement from the community but leaning into a narrative of victimhood that may not in fact be the case or may not accurately reflect the dynamics? Again, speaking broadly, but I do just kind of urge people to hold back before jumping to snap conclusions in general when these themes come forward, because viewing interactions on a one-off, it can skew our perception of what may or may not be actually going on, because very often what's happening behind closed doors and what's been happening over time in the overall context of the relationship may not be apparent in a single situation. Now, I make that point because I think it's a valuable point, and I fully acknowledge that it does not apply as much to that phone call as I had hoped.
All right. How are you doing so far? That's the end of part one. If you're ready, check out part two. It's episode 80. And that wraps up today's topics. We are so glad you stopped by. Be sure to join the Mormon Happy Hour on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Patreon. If you smiled, please drop us a 5-star review wherever you found us. See you next week. Cheers!